won the election. But Bush and the Republicans could take the rejection. They counted the votes in a web of deception. The GOP stole the election. It's a good thing that Saddam was captured, hiding in a hole just like a rat would. Now they're saying that the war went on because their intelligence was wrong. Was the reason for war based on lies and corruption? Where are the weapons of mass destruction?
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Today is Tuesday, and that means, with that special music, kick out the Republicans, that it is Election Tuesday. Every Tuesday from now till that most important Tuesday on November 2nd, we discuss what's going on between Democrats and Republicans, and your host, Mark Levine, yours truly, does something that Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly would never do. I actually bring on air someone who disagrees with me, because I believe that when you get down to the issues, when you discuss the issues, we Democrats win. The Republicans got to worry about the spin. They got to worry about the sound bites. They don't want to have a real discussion of the issues. But I'll tell you, I'm not afraid of strong debate, and that's why I've invited on the air Dan Schuberth. He is the state chair of the Maine College Republicans. We decided to go from Utah to Maine today to talk with Dan Schuberth and to give him a chance to state his views on the air. So, Dan, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, thanks, Mark. How'd you ever go from Utah to Maine, my friend?
Well, we had Tom Robbins, and I think we like him, but I think it's important to hear from someone in a blue state, a state that I think is going to go for John Kerry this fall, though I think it may well be close. I'm sure you disagree.
I think it's going to be incredibly close, Mark. I mean, we're on the ground day in and day out, and right now the latest poll came out that said it has us up by a point. Now, take that as you will. Maine is notorious, and I'm sure you know, for its garbage polling. So we've been up, we've been down. But right now, I mean, the consensus is that it's dead even. Second district is polling stronger for the president. You know, Maine's one of the few states that splits its votes in the country.
That's true. That's true.
So,
Maine and Nebraska are the two.
And the conservative estimate, excuse the expression, is that, you know, we're going to take at least one of these votes for the president. I'm pretty confident about that.
I'm not confident of that at all. I think we're going to win Maine, and I think that's the way it should be.
All right.
But I want to get with the issues and not just the question of who's up and who's down. And, of course, the big issue that's going to come up in the debate this Thursday night, in fact, is the issue of foreign policy, specifically the war in Iraq. And I got a real basic question for you. It's one you really should hit out of the park, but something that, frankly, I don't really understand. And I know you're going to give me a lot of reasons, so we'll just deal with them one by one. But it's a really basic question, one I hope you can help our listeners with. And that is, why are we in Iraq?
All right, well, like you said, Mark, we can go through a number of reasons for you, and I'm sure you'll disagree with every single
well,
one
let's,
of them.
Well, let's go reason by reason.
Number one, I think the reason why you're in Iraq is because Americans needed a strong response against the threat of global terrorism after 9/11.
Okay, hold on. So Iraq was a response to 9/11. That's your view?
I think it is, yes, sir.
All right. Now, explain to me why we're going into a country that never attacked us instead of going into the country that did attack us, because it may seem weird to you, but if somebody comes out and kills a member of my family, I just don't think it's right to go kill somebody else. I think we should go after the people that attacked us. Call me crazy.
Hey.
Explain to me why it is that Al-Qaeda and Afghanistan went and killed 3,000 Americans and we withdrew troops from Afghanistan to go fight the war in Iraq. Explain that to me.
Yeah, a couple points on that. Number one, first, Mark, we did go into Afghanistan immediately after 9/11.
Yeah, but we pulled out troops. We took out special forces. We took out the Predator drones that were looking for Osama bin Laden to go after Saddam Hussein. Tell me, do you believe Iraq was a greater threat to American security than Afghanistan?
Well, first, on the point of pulling troops out of Afghanistan, at this point today, we have more troops in Afghanistan than when we initially waged war in that country.
Okay, how many troops do we have in Afghanistan?
I can't give you a number, Mark.
I'll give you a number. It's about 20,000. And how many troops do we have in Iraq? It's about 140,000.
Sure.
And my question to you is, do you believe Iraq is, under Saddam Hussein, was seven times the danger to America than Afghanistan under the rule of Taliban and Al-Qaeda? Remembering, of course, that Afghanistan has a 50% greater population and a 50% greater area than Iraq.
I think that both events are mutually exclusive. I think, first of all, we were attacked by Afghanistan, no question about that. That's something we agree on.
Okay.
What we did is we went in and we removed the threat of the Taliban. They're gone. They're out of power right now.
Actually, they're not. I'm afraid that's not true. They are out of the power in the capital, Kabul, and I'm glad about that. But in the countryside, the Taliban, Mullah Omar, Al-Qaeda, they tend to be doing pretty well.
And as a result, what we're doing is we're continuing to maintain forces in Afghanistan and track them down out of the mountains that they're hiding in.
20,000. 20,000. Now, why is Iraq seven times more important than Afghanistan? Why
would it be? Look at it in terms of it being seven times more important. I think I'll make a couple arguments. Number one, I feel that Iraq was the next logical progression in terms of the war on terror. This is a country that has harbored terrorists and has been friendly to Al-Qaeda since its inception.
Okay, wait a minute. Next logical progression. You know, if it were me, I'd go after the people that attacked us and finish that job before taking a hornet's nest and hitting it over the head with a hammer and opening it up. But next logical progression, Iran is getting nuclear weapons. North Korea is getting nuclear weapons. Our president apparently doesn't care that much about that. Our military is too overstretched. Saudi Arabia funds the terrorists and Al-Qaeda. 15 of the terrorists came from Saudi Arabia. 4 came from Egypt, another dictatorship that we support. Why is it that Iraq is the next logical progression?
Well, let's roll back then. Are you advocating sending troops into Iran and North Korea there, buddy?
I'm advocating not ruling out the threat of force. Of course, now our military is so overstretched, cleaning up the mess, or trying to, that George Bush created, that it's really hard. I think we may have to have a draft to do it all, don't you think?
Well, hold on, Mark. Then in that case, are you advocating, let's say, President Bush marched troops into Iran? Would you support him in that?
Well, first of all, we have this mess in Iraq. Assuming we never went out against Saddam Hussein.
Sure.
I would advocate being very harsh with the rulers in Iran, insisting that they comply with democratic principles, being very strong in a multilateral way. Europe supports us on this, to insist that they disband the nuclear weapons, and yes, use the threat of force if necessary. Of course, we can't do any of those things because we're embroiled in the Iraqi quagmire.
So you think that these situations need to be addressed over the Iraq situation? You would advocate using force in both Iran and North Korea.
I advocate the threat of force. See, the nice thing about
Well, explain to me what that means.
Okay,
the threat of force. That sounds like a John Kerryism to me.
Well,
that
actually,
we pass a resolution that we don't actually go to war
and
fulfill that threat. Is that correct?
It's actually exactly what John Kerry voted for, and I supported him in that. I was not a Dean supporter that said don't even threaten Saddam Hussein with the use of force. I was a Kerry supporter. I say you authorize the president to do the use of force, and then you follow what the president said he was going to do. The president said that he was going to use the threat of force to make Saddam Hussein let the inspectors in, to gather international strength to fight Saddam Hussein, and then if Saddam Hussein didn't allow the inspectors in and we could prove that he was developing weapons of mass destruction, hey, we go in. But the nice thing about the threat of force is it doesn't have to be used. That's the nice thing about the threat of force.
Well, I'd remind you, Mark, that we used the threat of force for 6 months after we passed that resolution. It was 6 months later after that resolution was passed, as opposed to the first Gulf War in 91, where we went in 2 days later. We used 6 months waiting period to let that threat of force go through.
And
as a result, nothing happened.
Nothing happened. Were the inspectors allowed in or weren't they? Because, you know, people are trying to rewrite history. I seem to recall on TV the inspectors were actually allowed in. Are you denying that?
No, sir. The inspectors were allowed in.
Okay.
They weren't given ample time. They were stonewalled by
weren't given ample
not able to conduct the reasonable search by the United Nations.
Weren't given ample time. That's a wonderful argument. Who didn't give them ample time? Was it Saddam Hussein or George Bush?
It was Saddam Hussein that didn't give him ample time. He stonewalled. He moved. He had no threat to back him up. As a result, the United States went in after 6 months of playing his games, Mark.
No, it wasn't 6 months of playing the games. As I recall, France wanted just 30 more days to give the inspectors more time, and we refused.
After 6 months, Mark? After six months, they wanted 30 more days. They wanted to delay and delay and delay to stop the inevitable, which is going to war.
Did the inspectors find weapons of mass destruction?
No, sir, they did not.
Okay, then what was the justification for war? Your first justification was, hey, we needed to go in there as the logical progression after 9/11. I still haven't followed that one.
Sure.
Is there another reason we went in?
Well, let me jump in on the logical progression. Number one, we acknowledge, and John Kerry has acknowledged over and over and over again, before the president took any action, that Iraq was a direct threat to freedom and democracy.
Wait, a direct threat to freedom and democracy?
Yes, sir.
Now, come on, we can't do spin here. Tell me where you think John Kerry said that, freedom and democracy in America or in Iraq?
For both places. Number one, cited President Hussein as a dictator, as someone who oppressed his own people.
He was a dictator, no
doubt
about it.
He posed a direct threat to the United States of America. He advocated the removal of Saddam Hussein way before President Bush did.
I think we all advocate the removal of Saddam Hussein. Let me be clear. I advocate the removal of every dictator on Earth. I advocate the removal of North Korea's dictator, Iran's dictator, China's dictator. I want China's dictator to go away. I certainly advocate their removal.
But are you willing to put the troops in and make it happen, Mark?
No, I'm not willing to put troops into Beijing to make it happen. In fact, we didn't send troops to Moscow, and we still won the Cold War. To say that Kerry believed that Saddam Hussein would be better removed from power is to say something that really everyone believes. I mean, of course, it'd be nice. It'd be really nice if all dictators were removed from power. That would be really nice.
Sure, but the difference is, Mark, that John Kerry has said these things. We can all say them. You can say them. I can say them. President Bush is the one that took action and made it happen.
Wait a minute. You and I can both agree that the leaders of China, we would prefer were gone and that China was a democracy, right?
Sure.
Okay. So we just say that, but if we had a president willing to act on it and send, 100 million Americans to Beijing to invade, you'd, of course, support that, right?
No, I think it's a very different scenario. We need to look at the realities of war in that situation.
Thank you. Good. I'm glad we agree. There's a difference between saying I would prefer that a dictator not be there and to send American troops in without world support, without body armor, without enough funds to get it done.
Whoa. How can you mention body armor when your candidate didn't vote for the body armor to send the troops in to supply them with?
Actually, he did, and Bush threatened to veto it. Why did your boss flip-flop?
Whoa. Kerry did not vote against the $87 billion supplemental.
Kerry voted for an 86... Well, let's talk about body armor first of all.
Sure.
Of all, the president did not send the troops in with sufficient body armor. He didn't think it was necessary. It took several months, including families actually shipping their own body armor, buying it, shipping it to Iraq, before the president finally got the idea, I think we need body armor. The Democrats proposed the bill to give the body armor to the president. And then the president and John Kerry had a difference of opinion. You know this.
Well,
John Kerry,
issue was body armor, your candidate voted against eventually sending that to the troops.
John Kerry voted for body armor as long as it was paid for. The president threatened to veto body armor unless it wasn't paid for. Let's be clear about their positions here.
Be clear about the last statement you said. John Kerry favored body armor in what scenario?
There were two votes on body armor, as you know. The first vote, the one that John Kerry voted for, was a vote to supply our troops with body armor and to pay for it by taxing those that make $400,000 or more a year. They would have to take from their tax cuts, which averaged $100,000, $5,000 each, and pay for it. George Bush said, if that comes to my desk, I will veto it. I so support the rich that I will not even help our troops if it comes from their pockets. And Bush said, no, I want to run it up on the national debt. I want people like you, Dan, and people younger than you who don't even have a right to vote, I want all of you to pay twice the amount of taxes tomorrow because I don't want to fund it today. Please don't call it a flip-flop. Bush said, I will veto the bill to help the troops if it's paid for, but I'll support the one that isn't paid for. Kerry said, I will support the bill to aid the troops if it's paid for, but I won't support the one if it's not paid for. Now, who's the flip-flopper? Both candidates?
No, sir. I think the bottom line is that the vote that counted, the one that actually gave the body armor to the troops, was vetoed by Senator Kerry. That's it. It's done. He would not support it, regardless of how we pay for it.
Okay.
The president was willing to run a greater deficit to support our troops in combat.
Okay, but why would the president veto supplying arms to our troops in combat and then flip-flop and then promise to support the bill? That's a flip-flop, isn't it?
The president of the United States has two considerations at this point. The president is concerned about the troops in combat, and he had a plan to supply that body armor, which is different than Senator Kerry.
Now, wait a minute. Bush threatened to veto the plan if it were paid for. Now, and then he ended up supporting the bill when it wasn't paid for. Isn't that a flip-flop?
First of all, when we talk about things being paid for, when you run a deficit, you are paying for things with other supplemental funds. We're not talking about being paid for on the backs of the American people.
Sure you are.
The body armor would be paid for one way or another.
Well, wait. Are you saying we shouldn't pay our debts?
What I'm saying is this. I'm saying when we're quibbling over the term paid for,
right.
Both scenarios, this body armor is being paid for.
Right.
Paid for by different sources.
Exactly.
Do you agree on that?
Yeah. Kerry wants it to be paid for by rich people today. Bush wants to be paid by young people tomorrow.
What Kerry wants, he wants to roll... This is one of Kerry's schemes to roll back the tax plan of President Bush that has created an economic stimulus, which is why our economy is doing so well.
Hey, Dan, I want to get to the tax plan, and that's perfectly fair, but I just want to change the topic here. I think it's relevant, Mark, because I think we're talking about
something that ties into the president's economic package, which happens to do with the war in Iraq.
Well, no, we'll get to that, and we'll talk about it right after commercial. We'll talk about the tax cuts, but I want to get this $87 billion squared away because it is Exhibit A in the Bush claim that Kerry is somehow a flip-flopper. That is your prime example. And let's be clear on what's going on here. Either both candidates are flip-floppers because both supported aiding the troops and not aiding the troops, depending on whether it was paid for, or neither candidate's a flip-flopper. You have to agree with me when you support one version of the bill, but you don't support another version, okay? Kerry supported one version to aid the troops. He didn't support another version. George Bush supported one version to aid the troops, didn't support another version. To be consistent, either both candidates are flip-floppers or, to take a more nuanced view, both of them felt it should be paid for differently. How can you call Kerry a flip-flopper when George Bush has also been on both sides of the same issue?
Because the eventual vote which granted the body armor to the troops was vetoed by Senator Kerry. The other one fell away in committee. It was gone. It was done.
No, it was a vote. It was a vote for an amendment on the House floor. The amendment lost.
Correct.
That's true. And Bush threatened to veto it. That's one of the reasons why it lost. Would you condemn Bush for threatening to veto that bill?
No, sir. I think President Bush always intended to supply his troops. He wanted a different way of doing it and a more efficient way economically
Oh, wait. He always intended to supply his troops. So when he said he would veto the bill, he was lying? I'm just trying to understand your view here.
President Bush has always intended, I can't make this any more clear, he's always intended to supply the body armor to the troops.
So you're saying that when George Bush threatened to veto the body armor bill, if it were paid for by rich people, he threatened to veto it, that in fact was a falsehood?
He vetoed an amendment to that bill.
He threatened to veto
the original bill. He said this is an amendment which Senator Kerry and other Democrats have proposed of a way to pay for it.
Okay, I'm going to let some of our callers get on this because I definitely want them to have their say. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. 877-57-SCOOP. You can also do, as so many of you have, contribute to the blog. In fact, we had about 10 comments on the blog before this show even began. I love my listeners. Just go to www.radioinsidescoop.com, click on the blog, and have at it. We'll be reading some of your comments on the air. Let me go to my first caller. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Dan Schubert.
Hey, guys. How are you doing today?
Good. Is this Brian from New Jersey?
It is.
See, I recognize your voice. It's nice to hear from a regular. Brian, go at it.
I just want to know how Iraq is the next logical progression. You said that, you know, we've already given them 6 months and you didn't want to give France an extra 30 days. Well, we can watch from space with satellites, transports. If they're transporting massive amounts of weapons out of the country to Syria or any of these other countries, we can watch that and we can see. And there were no transports that we saw. And if they did have these weapons, which we haven't found, there's no way for them to bomb our country with them because they didn't have an Air Force, they didn't have a Navy that they could bring them over here. So in my opinion, wouldn't the next logical progression be somebody like North Korea, who has nuclear capabilities now?
And they could hit California,
very close
too.
To our allies?
They could hit California, North Korea. Dan?
Sure, I'm happy to respond to that. Number one, I think the threat we are dealing with and why it is so imperative that we go into Iraq is because we're not in a state of war right now as we were in the Cold War, where we're pointing missiles at each other and planning to hit our major city. At this point, the threat of Iraq is that it is a nation that has been friendly to and has harbored terrorist organizations over the years.
Well, no, wait a minute. Friendly to and harbored terrorists.
Let me finish that thought. They have harbored terrorists over the years.
But you'd agree.
Suicide bombers in Israel.
Right.
They've been friendly to outlandish regimes that have tried to attack us and will attack us.
Okay, but I can name 23 Arab states that have paid for terrorists that attacked in Israel. I can name at least 10 Arab states that have harbored terrorists and funded al-Qaeda far more than Iraq. Let's just give a few on al-Qaeda. There's Saudi Arabia, there's Yemen, there's Sudan, there's Egypt even, there's Syria and Lebanon, and there's certainly Iran that right now to this day is harboring al-Qaeda people that have escaped. There's Pakistan before 9/11. Every one of these countries, according to the 9/11 Commission report, according to the Senate Intelligence reports, had much stronger ties with al-Qaeda al-Qaeda much greater connection to September 11th than we did. How can you justify going after country number 9 at best when we got 8 other countries that have close connections to al-Qaeda?
Because the bottom line is that the UN has picked this country as one of the greatest threats.
Oh, they're so
the
it's the United Nations.
He will not follow UN resolutions. He will not disarm. The UN
right.
is under the impression
right.
he had weapons of mass destruction.
So Bush,
as a result, the UN targeted him for action. Then, unfortunately,
okay,
they didn't
Dan,
follow through with their targets and their threats.
Well, now, wait a minute.
So, it ended up being the United States that carried through and ousted him.
I thought Bush said, and correct me, tell me if this is a flip-flop, I thought Bush said that he wouldn't take American security from the United Nations, that he would defend based on America's interests, and that he felt the United Nations shouldn't control things. And they keep trying to peg John Kerry as doing whatever the United Nations says. Does the United Nations, should they control American foreign policy? Should they not control American foreign policy? And if not, why do you keep citing them?
The question you asked me was, why is Iraq on the target list?
It's on
the target
list
because it directly violated UN resolutions. That's what put them on the map as one of the dangerous, threatening countries that will not comply with international law.
Did the UN?
That's why they're on the map.
Okay,
now,
well,
result,
Dan.
The United States targeted them
as
a result of many intelligence issues that they had weapons, they had links to al-Qaeda, and other sources.
Links to al-Qaeda.
Why we decided to go into Iraq.
That's another issue. The question, I'll get to that in a second. Question one, did the United Nations say they violated UN resolutions, or is that just our guess?
They violated many, many resolutions.
Did the United Nations say so? They did? Was there a vote
on that?
Yeah, when was the United Nations vote authorizing the war? I remember Colin Powell going back to the United Nations begging countries.
There was no vote to authorize the war.
There wasn't.
The agreement that they violated UN resolutions.
Okay.
There's no question about it.
All right, so we say they violated UN resolutions, and therefore, even though the UN didn't consider it serious enough to do anything about, based on those...
And that's an issue that the own organization would not enforce their laws.
Well, I love it. So you have, why are we in Iraq? Because the United Nations says that we should be there, except they don't say we should be there because they're against it, and therefore we're there. Have I got it right?
No, not at all, Mark. The UN has targeted Iraq as a country that has disobeyed law after law after law.
Hasn't North Korea violated laws?
Unfortunately, they would not enforce their own laws. The United States came in and saw Iraq at the time as a result of their weapons of mass destruction, which we thought they did have, as a result of their links to al-Qaeda, as a result of the fact that they are harboring terrorists in their nation as we speak. These are reasons why the United States saw it as a direct threat to our national security, and we moved in.
Hey, Dan, Florida was harboring terrorists, as was Arizona. A number of states, the United States, that had the terrorists come in and go to flight schools. Should we be invading Florida, too?
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Well, how did they harbor terrorists?
But come on, Mark.
Well, I mean, they didn't...
Come on.
No, wait a minute. Wait. Saddam Hussein refused to cooperate with al-Qaeda, right? They did not like each other.
Then Florida has refused. What are you trying to tell me, Mark?
I'm just trying to understand your argument. They were harboring terrorists. Well, you know, Saddam Hussein didn't like al-Qaeda, refused to cooperate with al-Qaeda. So did Florida officials. All right. Both of them happened to have terrorists there at some point in time. Are you arguing that something's different here?
Mark...
I'm just trying to understand.
I'm trying to understand how you're trying to justify to me that we should invade the great state of Florida.
Well,
I got friends down there, buddy.
Well, you know, hey, listen, we have hundreds of countries that have had a terrorist in them, and including the United States, including Canada. Harboring terrorists, to me, suggests that they're purposely doing it. Can you argue that Saddam Hussein purposely did anything to help al-Qaeda in 9/11? Because if so, you'd be not only disagreeing with the 9/11 Commission sent intelligence reports, you'd be disagreeing with Colin Powell.
You're going to make the argument to me right now, hear that, Mark, that number one, Saddam was not friendly to terrorist organizations, he did not harbor any terrorist organizations in his country. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
I'm trying to tell you he was not friendly to al-Qaeda,
okay,
the country
right,
that attacked us.
But.
I'm telling you that there's some 20 Arab nations, unfortunately, that help terrorists attack Israel. That's true. I think that's unfortunate. I don't advocate invading all 20 of them.
So you
and
see
I'm telling
al-Qaeda
you that
the end-all and be-all of terrorist organizations, that none of them matter. He could have had 25 others, but hey, he doesn't have al-Qaeda in this country. That's okay. We can kind of give him a pass on that.
Al-Qaeda's who attacked America, though.
Does that matter to you?
It matters al-Qaeda? Because we're dealing with a threat of global terrorism that is larger than any one organization that we're facing.
Okay, but shouldn't we go after Osama bin Laden first?
Again, this is one organization, Mark, that attacked our country. We are going after him. We're still going after him. The bottom line is there are other organizations around that we need to be aware of and we need to face. And Iraq has maintained and controlled and supported many of these organizations. That's why we're there.
But we're not going to go to North Korea or Syria or Lebanon or Sudan where genocide's occurring, or Iran where they're harboring al-Qaeda and developing nuclear weapons, or Saudi Arabia, which funded it. No, we're not going to go after any of those, right?
Mark, the direct threat right now has been proven time and time again to be Iraq.
That's
the perception of the administration.
Okay, hold on.
Of Congress, that's why they authorized the war.
I want you to explain the direct threat to me, and then I got to get on to other callers because they're filling up the banks, which I think is good. what was, explain it to me very clearly.
Sure.
What was the direct threat that Saddam Hussein posed the United States of America? Are you saying he was going to take nuclear weapons and drop them over Chicago? If
not,
not
at all.
Okay, what was the threat?
The direct threat, as I explained before, right now in these times, we are not dealing with nations that are going to launch missiles at us like Russia. We are dealing with nations that actively train and harbor terrorists that will do and commit acts like we saw on 9/11.
No, wait a minute. The training?
Those countries,
okay, wait,
in my opinion, pose direct threats to the security of the United States.
Are you really arguing Saddam Hussein trained and harbored terrorists? I'd really like to see this because, as I'm aware, there were training camps in Sudan, in Afghanistan, in Yemen. Saudi Arabia funded them. What training camps were in Iraq?
What I'm asking, I mean, Mark, what,
you
the,
just said
the
they trained terrorists.
The argument you're trying to make to me here is that there are terrorist camps all over the world. We need to invade all of these countries. Is that what you're saying to me?
No, I'm just trying to understand your justification why we invaded one and not the other. If I had my first choice, I'd go to Sudan where genocide is occurring because I think that's the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world. I'd also consider taking out the Yongbyon nuclear plant in North Korea and doing something against Iran as well. But unfortunately, our military is pretty overstretched right now because George Bush...
You're sounding kind of hawkish to me there, buddy.
What's that?
You're sounding kind of hawkish to me there, buddy.
Well, look, if
roll up your sleeves and get in there, huh?
What I'm saying is if Iraq is justified, all of these other countries are more justified. If you're going to take a sledgehammer and pound it on a flea, right, I think that you might want to go after the three people that are pointing guns at you. Because the flea is less dangerous. Yeah, it can bite you, but it won't kill you. Why aren't we going after Osama bin Laden? Don't you? I mean, there's...
Mark, how can you explain to me right now that we are not going after Osama bin Laden? Do we not have troops in Afghanistan?
We
are not combing through mountains and ditches and holes to try to find Osama. How can you make the argument that we are not going after Osama bin Laden?
We have 20,000 troops in a country that's the size of Texas, and we've got 140,000 troops in a country that's the size of California.
And these troops don't need to, rebuild the country that has been destroyed by its dictator? Is that it? I mean,
that's exactly.
You're making the argument that we need more troops in Afghanistan to hunt Osama bin Laden.
Right.
We need less troops rebuilding the structure of Iraq and creating a democracy.
No, I'm telling you, we don't have enough troops, period. Our military's overstretched. That's why I think George Bush is probably going to have to do a draft in his second term.
Is that what you want, Mark?
No, I don't. I don't think we should have gone to Iraq to begin with. Brian, I'm going to give you one last word, and then I got lots of callers hanging on.
Real quick. Hans Blix, head of the UN weapons inspection team, said there were no weapons of mass destruction. Rumsfeld said he knew where they were around Baghdad. 15 out of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabians. That's a pretty big statistic. Osama and Saddam were not friendly. The only al-Qaeda that was in Iraq was in northern Iraq, which Saddam had no power over. And Timothy McVeigh, I know it's a little bit off, but not really, he bombed Oklahoma City in order to, hopefully, this was his hope, to get Bill Clinton to lock down on the white American gun owners. And he didn't. He arrested Tim McVeigh as a criminal. And that is exactly what Osama bin Laden and these other criminals did. It's not a war on terrorism because you can't have a war on an idea. You can have a war against the country. And unfortunately, yes, Florida does harbor terrorists and other states do harbor terrorists. No, we can't just lock it down unless you want to go into martial law. So we should be prosecuting these people as criminals and not having a war and rebuilding nations, which is not something the United States should be doing. Thanks, guys.
Brian, I think that was very well put. Thank you very much for your call. Dan, go ahead.
Second comment is the direct contrast between Senator Kerry's view of terrorism and Senator Bush's. Senator Kerry views this as a law enforcement issue. These are individual criminals, not part of global networks, not part of a more serious issue, fact that we have terrorists. We want to bring down the very walls and foundations of the United States.
Well,
this is a war and not a law enforcement issue, as Senator Kerry would have you see.
When did Senator Kerry ever call the attacks by al-Qaeda a law enforcement issue? Go ahead. Give me the citation because I've never seen it. Tell me when he said that. Give me date,
time.
It's the
way he goes about these issues. It's the way he the Patriot Act, for example.
All right. So he never said it was a law enforcement issue. That's just your spin on what he said. All right. That's fair. But let's just be clear. Kerry never said that. I mean, we could talk about the Patriot Act and the tax cuts and a lot of things, but Kerry never called it a law enforcement issue. I got to go to a commercial break.
I have it right here, Mark, but we'll take commercial first.
Take a commercial first. You come back and you show me where John Kerry said that the fight against al-Qaeda or against 9/11 was a law enforcement issue. I'd really like to see it. Right now, we got to take a commercial break. We got lots of callers hanging on. We're going to get to all your calls. A great discussion. Dial 877-57-SCOOP. 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop this Election Tuesday right after this.
It's time to make the Republicans quit.
If you think that the Bushites had no post-war plan for what they would do in Iraq after our military ousted Saddam, think again. You can see their plan in the extremist economic policies that were quietly and autocratically imposed on the Iraqi people during the reign of L. Paul Bremer III, who was our occupying czar there. While America's media establishment has been focused on the raging war by Iraqi insurgents and by the Bushites' attempt to enthrone a puppet government there, the neocon laissez-faire zealots in the administration have been gleefully using this ravaged country as their own ideological playground. For years, these Ayn Randian theorists have longed to create their utopia of a corporate state, and they've used the IMF, World Bank, WTO, and other monkey wrenches to try to implement their theories in Latin America and elsewhere. But they've never had an entire economy at their disposal, until they grabbed Iraq. While Baghdad was burning, Bremer arrived. Rather than putting out the fires, he used them as a distraction to issue decrees that instantly opened up Iraq to a total corporate takeover. For example, his decrees open up all of that nation's public assets to foreign corporate ownership, and they allow 100% of the country's industries, from banking to food, to be owned by foreigners. Also, Bremer ruled that 100% of the profits that foreign investors make in Iraq can now be hauled out of the country. There's no requirement that any of these profits be reinvested there, nor that the investors have to pay even a dime in taxes on the profits they haul away. This isn't liberation, as the Bushites call their Iraqi adventure. It's legalized looting, and is fueling the continuing anger and armed resistance by the Iraqi people, who are determined not to have their nation looted. This is Jim Hightower saying, to get this full story, see Naomi Klein's explosive article in Harper's Magazine. You can read it at harpers.org.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
Hello from the road, folks. You know, the only thing better than a twofer is a threefer. That's why this fall I'm staying at Econo Lodge and Roadway Inn Hotels. See, I get triple Southwest Airlines Rapid Rewards credit every time. So I earn flights three times faster. Call 800-4-CHOICE or visit choicehotels.com. We'll see you there.
Offer good for qualifying stays in the U.S. before November 30th, 2004. For details, visit choicehotels.com. Triple credit means 1.5 credits instead of the standard 0.5.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Today is Election Tuesday, and as part of Election Tuesday, we are debating. I'm debating Dan Schuberth. He is the state chair of the Maine College Republicans. Dan, are we giving you quite a harsh debate here?
Hey, man, it's going well, Mark.
Okay, all right. If you don't mind, we'll just keep it going, talking about the issues. We've been bringing it on, talking about Iraq. I got a number of callers on the line, and I also got a number of blog entries. I'm going to be reading some of those through in just a few minutes. But first, Dan, you said that you had some proof that Kerry said that the war against Al-Qaeda was somehow a law enforcement matter. Can you show that proof to me?
Yeah, the best place to find that, I mean, you want to look at NBC's Hardball, MSNBC's Hardball for September 8th of 2003, said it flat out, and it's exactly the argument that defines the Kerry approach to the war on terrorism, or he wouldn't call it a war, rather, and the president's stance to the war on terrorism. And the quote is this. He considers the war on terror, quote, far more of a law enforcement and intelligence operation than it is a day-to-day huge military operation. And that's a radically different stance than the president takes on it.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to take a look at that specific site. In fact, when we're done, you can post it on the blog.
Chris Matthews on the phone.
I will take a look at the site, and we'll go through it. I'll give you a response on my blog soon.
Sure.
I do think it is important to use law enforcement to capture terrorists. I don't think that's exclusively Kerry's position. But I do want to get to the phones. We got a lot of people hanging on. They want to tangle with you or with me. I'm not sure which. Let's go to my first of my callers. Caller. You're on the line with Mark Levine and Dan Schuberth. What's your first name? Where are you from?
This is Bert from Minnesota.
Hey, Bert from Minnesota. What's your comment or question or challenge?
I wanted to switch gears here a bit and talk about Bush's reputation, at least perceived as by myself and many people overseas whom I've talked to, as a person who is selling off the government to the highest bidder.
Okay.
Let me go over some data.
Sure.
His Undersecretary of Agriculture, Mark E. Ray, was a former lobbyist for the mining industry. He's been put in charge of public lands, and part of his actions that he's done while in his position was reducing the public and legal oversight for mining.
Okay.
Stephen Griles, Deputy Director of... I'm sorry, I don't have that right here, but he's a former coal lobbyist,
okay.
And he redefined laws. I'm sorry, the Mark E. Ray was he's in charge of forests.
Okay.
You've got Cheney's Energy Commission, who we still don't know much about it, but we do know from a Freedom of Information Act that Paul O'Neill got, where they divided up Iraq into different areas controlled by oil companies, American oil companies. So you see all this stuff all the time about, you know, Bush is going to look the other way or redefine things based on the interests of people who contribute to his campaign coffers. Just
okay,
look at
Bert.
What's going on with Tom DeLay. And my question to your guest is, what does he say to that? He said, if you have no money, the president has no interest in you.
Hey,
if
Dan.
If you have a lot of money, the president is going to bend things to your way. And
okay, let me pose a question to Dan. Dan, you got the Energy Commission with oil interests on it. You got the coal guys in charge of our forests. You've got polluters in charge of agriculture. Don't you think that Bush is selling off to the highest bidder all our national resources?
I think that most of this is hearsay and rhetoric. I think the biggest rhetoric that I hear is that Halliburton controls the government. I can't stand that.
But you switch topics.
You subscribe to that, Mark, the whole Halliburton craze.
Well, I actually do have a problem with Halliburton, but I don't want you to switch topics on me,
that's
Dan.
I think it's all relevant. Halliburton is the big evil energy company that's coming in and running our government, buying contracts in Iraq, winning no-bid contracts.
I think Halliburton
is
a big...
The argument we're trying to make right here is that big business controls the government. Is that right?
Yeah, I think Halliburton is a big evil corporation, but Burt has very specific charges, and I don't know if you know about this, but he named three guys... three examples of people in charge of various industries being put in charge of the government. You got
right.
The coal guy in the forest. You got oil companies and the Energy Commission. Do you have a problem with that, Dan?
I don't have a problem with these folks as long as they're doing a good job. And what I think is, in terms of the forest industry, in terms of the environment, in terms of these other industries, these folks are doing a fantastic job maintaining our national resources. That's what I think.
Well,
I can cite some issues with that in terms of Clean Air Act, clear skies, healthy forest initiatives. We can go into all that in detail if you want to talk about the environment. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, you guys are trying to paint the country as going to hell in a handbasket because George Bush has his cronies in office. That's simply not the case. I want to hear facts to back that up.
Well, one I don't like is the arsenic in our water and the mercury there either. But, Bert, I'm going to give you one last word. Go ahead.
Let me jump in on mercury real quick. I mean, the president is the first one to put mercury standards into place in the first place. No other president has done that
he
before.
Cut
You're not
the,
a fan of mercury. Hey, guess what? George Bush isn't either.
He cut the Clinton standards. But go ahead, Bert, you get one last word.
It's not a problem of them not running it well enough. It's a problem that they've gutted standards. They've undermined the ability of courts and the public to of oversight. They've refused Freedom of Information Act requests, whereas the Clinton administration actually said you better have a really good reason for refusing them. It's not a matter of running it quote unquote well. It's a matter of taking away the checks and balances whereby the U.S. government has worked for over 200 years.
Thank you very much for your call, Bert. I appreciate it. There have been a lot of comments on the blog, and I want to read some of them to you. Yes, there are jokes about Maine, lots of things about moose and lobsters. I will not read those on the air.
But hey, come on, man.
You want to hear the moose and lobster jokes that my listeners wrote? You could read it in your own spare time.
Give me one, Mark.
Oh, all right. Let's see here. What if a moose wins the lottery? Can he open a Red Lobster franchise in Maine?
Oh.
Exactly. You don't want to hear any more of this.
I think we'll cut it off at that point.
Let's get to some serious issues raised by my people that are listening on the blog. And, hey, if you want to call in and take Dan on or take me on, all you have to do is pick up the phone and dial 877-57-SCOOP, toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. Let's read what some of the people have written on the blog. We've got Matt. He writes, why did the troops not have body armor when they first deployed? And planning for war, is it not wiser to always prepare for the worst? Great question, Matt. You have an answer, Dan?
I think, obviously I'm not the military mastermind behind all this stuff. I think they're obviously...
No, neither is our president, apparently.
...without body armor. I think, number one, we anticipated that the war was going to be much like traditional warfare. We'd go in, hit them hard via the air, and spend a short presence of time on the ground. And as a result, given some factors that surfaced after the war... or during the war, we realized that we couldn't do that. We had to put more troops on the ground than we wanted to put on the ground, and we had to adjust and change our plan and fund body armor.
Okay,
so again,
Dan, but here's the problem.
I can't give you reasons militarily why we did not do it in the first place, but that's my assumption.
Well, here's the problem, Dan. What you've said is that we didn't plan for it, and we realized it later. Now, we did have people that did plan for it. You had General Eric Shinseki, who said we needed a lot more troops. He was fired. We had a number of studies by the Pentagon and the State Department saying that we would not be greeted as liberators, that we needed, this was going to be a protracted war, and all those studies were ignored. In fact, we still have studies today telling us that there's no possibility that Iraq will have any significant elections. Bush calls those studies just guessing. Let me read. This is from a CIA analyst last summer. They wrote, quote, chaos after war will turn Iraq into a laboratory for terrorists, unquote. You know, it's not like the president wasn't warned. Maybe he didn't read these things, but Bush clearly knew. Or if he at least his advisors knew. Again, I don't know if Bush actually does the reading, but he knew that this thing was going to be serious, and he didn't take action for it, against it. Let me read some more quotes I've got on my blog.
Sure.
We got Rick says, I feel so much safer. We don't have to worry about that evil Iraq invading America. Hey, if we didn't stop Iraq, we'd all be speaking Arabic. We better be careful. Maybe the Congo is going to invade us next. He also writes, the nation of Iraq didn't have to be rebuilt because it was destroyed by a dictator. It has to be rebuilt because of 10 years of sanctions and the massive bombing by American forces. Let me go to one of the callers we've got hanging on. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Dan Schubert.
Yeah, this is Gordon from Michigan.
Hey, Gordon, go at it.
Yeah, I would contend that going into Iraq was about hitting the cripple.
Okay.
We were facing frustration at that point in time about getting Osama. He was holed up in the hills, and we were losing a lot of men up there, and we weren't getting them. And about that time, we decided to confront Saddam with the inspectors. And Bush had about, I believe he had about a 30-day window of opportunity, which his military advisors were saying, if you don't go in 30 days, you might as well wait another year, or else the weather will be the preponderant issue.
That's
that always is when you go crushing across that desert like that.
Except that
so I think that's what that rushing to war was about going into Iraq without the proper armor. It was about that window of opportunity, and also with a lack of dealing with proper diplomacy with the UN and other countries, Bush was under pressure to work with this window of opportunity. I wonder if Dan could comment about that.
Dan, go ahead.
Just in terms of the rushing to war, I have trouble when people make that argument. When we passed the Gulf War resolution in 91, we went to war 2 days later. In this sense, we passed the resolution 6 months before we sent troops to Iraq. How can you describe that as rushing to war? I want to hear that.
Well, my response, Dan, is that there are two different resolutions. The United Nations and the world community authorized us to go to war because it was a violation of international law for Iraq to invade Kuwait. In turn, the United Nations says it's a violation of international law for us to invade Iraq, and there's a big difference there.
But address the point on rushing. I mean, we're talking about law and international community. How can you say that, one, we are rushing, when we went 2 days after a resolution?
It's very simple, Dan. It's very simple. Let me explain. Iraq was in Kuwait. That was an emergency situation. They were in there. This was an emergency? What was the emergency? Iraq was going to do what? If we didn't invade Saddam right away, Iraq was going to do what, Dan?
To continue training and developing terrorism in its country to send abroad.
That's the emergency?
Terrorists are being trained. We know about it. We're not going to go in and stop it.
Well, no, wait. I just want to use your logic here. If the emergency is that Iraq was training terrorists, something, frankly, that I haven't seen. I know they gave some money to Hezbollah, as did 20 Arab countries. If the emergency was training terrorists, okay, and that's the emergency that caused us to act and not wait for the world community and not even wait for body armor, then why didn't we simultaneously invade Saudi Arabia, Iran, North Korea, Sudan, Yemen, and Egypt?
So you keep making that argument. I don't understand what, I mean, do you...
You just said it's an emergency.
The United States physically, in terms of military technology and strategy, can invade all these countries at once.
I don't think so.
We have to pick a target and go after it.
Right.
And then when that target is resolved, we have a democracy built, we address the other issues in the international community.
Terrific. I agree with you. My target is Afghanistan. Let me go to the next caller. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Dan Schubert.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. What's your first name? Where are you from?
Hi, my name's Don. I'm from Macomb, Michigan.
Hey, Don from Michigan.
Great county of Macomb, Michigan. I just would just kind of like to comment on a caller that said, you know, that, you know, big business is running Iraq and so on and so forth. But, you know, if that really made any sense, you know, we wouldn't be sending billions and billions of dollars to Israel every year. I mean, they have no natural resources to offer. They really don't give us too much in return except to be a democracy in a very hostile place of the world. And I think Americans are starting to see, you know, the situation, you know, in Iraq and how it is making us safer and how we are taking it to them.
Don, tell me, how is Iraq making America safer? Explain that to me.
Well, I mean, just like how Dan said, I mean, we knew terrorists were getting support.
Well, no, but terrorists right now are far more in Iraq than ever under Saddam Hussein. I mean, you don't have to believe me. You can read the National Intelligence Estimate, the thing that George Bush says they're just guessing, or the State Department reports or the Senate Intelligence reports. Al-Qaeda is having a field day. They had never had a base in Iraq, and now they're having fertile recruitment efforts and whole swaths of the country controlled by insurgents. Aren't there more terrorists in Iraq than there were under Saddam Hussein?
Well, this is why I believe you know, the United States is now kind of swaying towards Bush right now, is because time after again, leftists, you know, such as yourself, are marginalizing the accomplishments that we are making, you know, abroad. I mean, we have 25 million new, you know, Iraqis free that can actually
free.
Start something. And I mean, to even marginalize, to say that somehow Iraq was somewhat better, I mean, under Saddam Hussein, is just completely hogwash.
Here's the problem. When you call someone free and they don't agree, who's right?
I mean,
you got 25 million Iraqis.
Country saying that we aren't free.
No,
I mean, saying,
I've seen the polls.
You know, power to the people.
Wait a minute.
It's all 25. The beholder, and quite frankly, I think the majority of Americans are starting to see really what reality is like in this post 9/11 world.
Don, you got 25 million Iraqis.
Sure.
The poll I saw by the Coalition Provisional Authority of whether Americans were liberators or occupiers, 2% of Iraqis said liberators, 98% occupiers. Fox News had a poll. Fox News, as we all know, swings their polls over to the Republicans. They found 5% of Iraqis considered us liberators, 95% considered us occupiers. So let's say that 1 in 20 considered themselves free, while meanwhile, Al-Qaeda, you didn't have a base. We took away their base in Afghanistan. Now they've got a base to train terrorists against the United States, and you think we're safer than we were?
You look at it like this. I mean, you're arguing perceptions, and pretty much I believe that that is just all smoke and mirrors being, you know, produced here by the liberal media. And I believe that you're going to see in 20 years, quite frankly, that the Middle East is going to be a far more stabler place because of President Bush's policies.
It's clear to see
that we are building a democracy. And pretty much the Kerry campaign and leftists such as yourself are arguing against.
Well, first of all,
democracy.
I'm not a leftist.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I mean, Americans are seeing this. I mean, whether or not,
Don,
we agree.
Don, what world are you living in?
I mean, Americans are starting to see the clear picture here.
Well, why is it that you're right and the CIA is wrong and the State Department is wrong and the Pentagon is wrong? I mean, these are studies commissioned by Rumsfeld
I mean, the CIA was wrong about weapons of mass destruction.
No, they were right.
Towards, you know, John Kerry voting against every single CIA appropriation.
Hold on, well, that's not true either. That's false. We've dealt about that in past programs. By the way, the CIA said it wasn't true. It was Tenet that called it a slam dunk.
Wasn't he a Clinton appointee?
Tenet was a Clinton appointee.
Okay.
I didn't like him then. I didn't like him now. Here's the heart of it. If all of our intelligence, is so faulty that they gave the president wrong information about Afghanistan, you know, that we're going to be attacked. I think they gave him right information. They gave him wrong information about intelligence. They gave him all this stuff. Why won't Bush fire anybody? I'm going to give Don a chance to answer that, give Dan, and then I got other callers on the line. Don, you first. Why isn't Bush fired anybody?
Well, being in Washington, D.C., Mark, I'm sure you know how politics work. People just don't get fired. People move on.
I would fire anyone who lied to me.
They go out their separate ways, and I think that's what happened with George Tenet. I think that, you know,
Bush says he didn't fire Tenet.
What's that?
Bush says he didn't fire Tenet.
He didn't.
Why isn't he fire Rumsfeld?
Embarrassed. I think he was embarrassed that the intelligence, you know, they didn't have the capabilities to fund their intelligence agency. I mean, it was eroding. I mean, look at the whole entire world. Look at the British intelligence, you know. Every single intelligence agency around the world thought the same thing we did.
Not true.
And I mean, that's just a testament to how much emphasis or lack of what we were putting on our funding our intelligence agency through the Clinton years and through John Kerry's tenure. I mean,
you know, what this shows me, Don, people believe what they want to believe, but thank you. I appreciate your call, and I hope you'll call in another time. I'm going to give Dan a chance. Go ahead.
Dealing with the intelligence faults that we ran into going into this war, and fault the intelligence on both ends,
We've had two big proposals. We have a Department of Homeland Security, which is now streamlining our intelligence operations here. We've also been, we're going to appoint an intelligence czar, or we have appointed an intelligence czar, that's going to streamline the activities of the CIA and the FBI.
You know, I really wish that were all true.
Brought in light of the newfound war on terrorism and the challenges that our nation's facing at home and abroad today. These are two major reforms.
Dan, I wish that were true. I'll tell you, I used to work on the committee, the House committee overseeing the Department of Homeland Security, and found to my surprise, really quite surprised, George Bush did not support giving intelligence to this Department of Homeland Security that he opposed and then he supported in a flip-flop. In fact, he set up his own separate intelligence organization called the Terrorist Threat Integration Center, or TTIC, one you don't hear a lot about but doesn't have congressional oversight. So unfortunately, he's not getting to the Department of Homeland Security what he needs to get to them, and I think that's a real problem. I want to move on, though, and talk a little bit about domestic issues in the short time we have left, and also I haven't run a commercial in a while. Let me go to a quick commercial break, and we'll be back with the last few minutes talking about domestic issues. There's still a chance to get your calls in. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back.
Governor Jeb Bush is out to make his state of Florida the next Florida. In 2000, Jeb used such crude political tactics as illegally purging voter lists to help engineer his brother's 537-vote victory in that election. And now, here he goes again. As one peer of Florida's GOP establishment candidly puts it, a Democrat can't win a statewide election in Florida without a high turnout of African Americans. It's no secret that the name of the game for Republicans is to restrain that turnout as much as possible. The Orlando League of Voters can attest to that. This African American civic group has played a big role in turning Orlando from a Republican stronghold into a city that increasingly votes Democratic. Their reward for getting involved in the democratic process is to have Jeb Bush's state police suddenly come knock, knock, knocking on the doors of some 50 of the league's grassroots leaders. These leaders, mostly elderly black women, find it frightening to be confronted in their homes by armed troopers interrogating them about their electoral participation. They're not charged with any crime. Instead, police say they're investigating vague allegations that some voter fraud might have occurred in this spring's mayoral election. Yet Jeb's own state police honcho wrote in a May letter that, quote, there was no basis to support the allegations, and he declared this matter closed. But it has not closed. Police now say the chief's letter was poorly worded. And the intimidating in-home interrogations continued this summer as the presidential election heated up. Jeb's police action is creating a blanket of fear among the league's volunteers who worry that their perfectly legal efforts will land them in jail. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course Jeb says that there's no political motive involved, but when asked how long the Orlando investigation will go on, police say it might continue right through November 2nd.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first six payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, we eliminate the middleman? Well, one thing's pretty certain. It wasn't the middleman. And how did they eliminate him? Something fishy there. But I digress. GEICO pioneered direct-to-consumer car insurance over 65 years ago, and they've been saving smart drivers money ever since. Give them a call, and you might ask them, what did they do with the middleman?
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO, 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
$1 billion deficit. It's time to make the Republicans quit.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Just got a few minutes left here. I've got my guest. He's undergone a withering assault by many of our callers, but he stood up just okay. And in fact, we just had a caller, Don from Michigan, on his side of the aisle. So that just shows that we have lots of people listening to the Inside Scoop. Dan, let me move on to the national economy. Because
before that, though, I just got to ask, where do you get that CD?
Oh, that CD was submitted to me by a guy in Los Angeles. I can't believe his name escapes me right now, but you don't like my music?
I just want to cruise down the street with my windows down and listen to that, you know?
Well, hey, you know what I'll do? At the end of the hour, I will play that music for all my internet listeners. I'll play a full rendition of the song, and then you can listen to the entire song. All you have to do is download the archive after this show. So you and our Arla listeners will it was submitted to me gratis by a listener in Los Angeles who made it himself, and I can't believe the name escapes me right now. I'll put it on my blog because he should get credit. Hey, let me ask you, I got a really interesting comment on the blog from Fred in New York City, and this is what Fred writes. He writes, "Mark, you're hitting home today. I am a graduate of the University of Southern Maine, and I used to live and work in Portland before the Bush recession decimated the economy. Bush's economic policies are the reason why I'm Fred in New York City instead of Fred in Portland. I was just in Old Orchard Beach this weekend for a reunion with old school buddies and work friends, and while the majority of them have degrees from Maine universities, they are all struggling to get by. I have one friend who, in spite of his four-year degree, now works part-time at UPS. My ex-roommate is a teacher in Kennebunkport, but he has to work part-time at a supermarket to make ends meet. Another was looking for work for over a year, only to find a temporary job that will end in a few months. Fred writes, Mainers are not a bunch that are afraid to put in a hard day of work, but when there's no jobs to be had, it doesn't matter. Most of us who went to school in Maine, myself included, couldn't do that today because we depended on federal assistance that is no longer available under Bush. Even if Dan is a Republican, how can he be in Maine and be for Bush? Dan?
Wow.
Pretty strong, huh?
Hey, man. Well, it's always good to hear from folks at USM. We got a great College Republican chapter down there.
Yeah, unfortunately, Fred had to leave Maine. I thought it was a very powerful thing he wrote on the blog. How do you respond to people like Fred?
Yeah, I'll be real clear with that. We need to draw very... And this is an issue we deal with daily basis on Maine, especially me as a youth leader in the organization, trying to find jobs for folks when they graduate. This is a big thing for us. And what we need to make a very clear distinction about... What laws are affecting Maine jobs? Maine has, number one, the highest tax burden in the country right now in terms of states. Two, it has the highest regulations on its small businesses. Work is leaving Maine. Small businesses do not want to do business in Maine when they can go next door to New Hampshire where there's no taxes. They let you do whatever you want in New Hampshire. So as a result of this poor business climate, jobs are leaving Maine. This has nothing to do with the president's policies. The president has cut taxes and created economic stimulus all over the country. So what we're dealing with are harsh Maine laws.
Okay, and are these Maine laws new under Bush, or did they exist under Clinton as well?
Oh, no. Jobs in Maine have always been a big issue here. We've always had high taxes, high regulations under our Democratic legislature, which has existed over the last 30 years.
Now, wait a minute. So you're arguing...
The governor, who's been in there for the last 12 years.
So you're arguing the conditions aren't any worse under Bush than they were under Bill Clinton?
I would argue that the conditions are better because the president is finally cutting federal taxes and providing some relief for working families in Maine that they haven't gotten from their local legislators.
Well, I'll tell you, Dan, I haven't seen the figures in Maine. I'll admit that right up front. But I can tell you that nationally, you see that the average wage, the medium wage, has gone down for every 3 years under George Bush. It went up for 8 years under Bill Clinton. If you look at jobs, you see that George Bush is the first president since Herbert Hoover to actually lose jobs.
I mean,
you
well,
see that
well,
there are poverty.
You can't make that argument. You understand.
It's true.
I mean, you guys aren't denying that we were attacked and that our economy was thrown into shambles for a year.
You're
right?
Not you denying that the recession began in March 2001, 6 months before the attack, are you, Dan?
Not at all, and I'm saying
okay.
That was a Clinton recession. I think that's been agreed on by economists as well.
Who was president in March 2001?
President Bush was president.
Thank
he inherited
you.
A recession that began 7 months before. That's been documented on Wall Street.
Well, wait. We just decided the recession began, and I'm citing the National Bureau, National Economic Advisors. I'm citing the national statistics. If
sure.
anyone wants to fight them, it would be Bush who could fire them all, which unfortunately is the kind of thing he likes to do. But March 2001.
Oh, I thought he didn't like to fire folks. That's why he has all the intelligence.
He does. Ah, here's the difference, Dan. He doesn't fire people who lie to him, who give him false intelligence, because I think, frankly, they told him the truth and he disregarded them. He does fire people, though, who tell him the truth. Eric Shinseki told him the truth, fired. Paul O'Neill insisted that Bush not lie in his State of the Union speech. He was fired. Bush has a habit of letting go people who tell him the truth. People that lie to him, well, hey, they're still in office, unless, and this is what I believe, they actually told him the truth, and Bush didn't follow it, and that's why they're not fired. The clearest example of that is George Tenet, who knew about Musawi, knew about the 20th hijacker. On the day of the attack, he thought back to this guy. I think he told Bush about it, and that's why I think Bush didn't fire him.
Well, let's get back on the economy line.
Okay, you only got 1 minute left, and then I got to close it up because it's been a great discussion, but the hour's ending. So 1 minute.
Well, two things. I mean, whenever we debate the left, or whenever I debate the left, always comes up that quote about Herbert Hoover. And we disregard the fact that, number one, we faced a serious recession as soon as the president took office. And number two, our nation was attacked, and we lost over a million jobs in a matter of a couple days. We've been recovering from that.
A million jobs. Al-Qaeda destroyed a million jobs. I'd love to see that statistic.
That statistic? I'll take a look at the job figures in the month after we were attacked on September 11th. Over a million jobs were lost during that period.
During the month after September 11th?
Economic stimulus.
Wait, you argue that a million jobs were lost during the month after September 11th?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you can post that on my blog as well. I tell you, our time is coming to a close. Oh, wait, one of my listeners reminds me it was Donnie Daly who gave us the music. Thank you for that, Bert. Bert from Kansas tells me it's Donnie Daly. He's absolutely right. It was Donnie Daly that gave us the song. Here's my view on the economy. The heart of it is that when you take money from the middle class and the poor and you give it to the rich, which Bush has done, increasing the middle class tax burden that Dan's talking about in Maine, George Bush has increased the amount of money that people making under $200,000 a year have to pay to the government. They have a higher burden. He's also increased the debt that youth in the future have to pay for. And yes, it is true that George Bush has the worst economy since Herbert Hoover. Guess what, folks? We've had bad recessions before. We had them under Republican presidents and Democratic presidents. But none of them have the ignominious distinction that George Bush has of ending his term with less jobs than we started. But hey, Dan, I get the last word. That's part of the advantage of it being my show. I do hope you'll come in again and debate me another time here on The Inside Scoop. Will you come back, or did we scare you away?
Mark, no one scares me, buddy. I had a great time with you today.
Great.
Really enjoyed it.
I hope you'll come back. Tomorrow we've got a very important show. We're going to talk about how George Bush is losing the Cold War. We fought so hard to win the Cold War with so much money spent and so much military might spent. Now Putin is turning toward dictatorship. And on tomorrow's show, we've got two terrific guests. We've got a professor from Stanford who's going to explain to us exactly how Putin is turning toward dictatorship and what the United States can still do to stop it if George Bush stops admiring Vladimir Putin, actually does something about it. And we've also got a Russian scholar himself, someone who born in Russia, lived his life there. He's going to come on air and talk about democracy in the former Soviet Union. You won't want to miss it. That's tomorrow's show. I want to thank my guest, Dan from Maine.
Hey, Mark, last question for you. Was Utah and Maine too much for you? Did we kind of overwhelm you a little bit?
Not in the least, and I want you to bring it on anytime. That's it for the Inside Scoop. Tune in tomorrow. Let me just close, as I often do, by citing John Kerry. Don't love your country, right or wrong. That's like loving your mother, drunk or sober. Love your country when it's right, and when it's wrong, make it right. This is Mark Levine signing off.
November of 2004, we've got a game. Bush says he cares about the middle class, but the giant corporations get all the cash. We got a $500 billion deficit. It's time to make the